Good evening, welcome to Behind the News for September 12, 2002. This is Doug Hendwin. Looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics, we've got two segments, really, but in several parts scheduled for tonight. First, we'll talk with two folks in Johannesburg, Moha Peko of the Africa Trade Coalition, I believe it's called, and we'll talk to her about the recent World Summit for Sustainable Development and neoliberalism, privatization issues, and the protest movement that was given great impetus by that summit and counter-demonstrating against that summit. And we'll also talk to a frequent guest here, Patrick Bond, also there in Johannesburg, for his observations. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak, we'll play two interviews recorded earlier today with some folks from the Council on Foreign Relations, the ultimate establishment foreign policy think tank, and what their views are on President Bush's speech to the UN this morning and the growing sound of war drums surrounding Iraq. And it seemed for a little while like there was some disagreement in elite levels of the U.S. that thought that maybe W was going a little too fast in moving against Iraq, but these folks in the Council on Foreign Relations seem to be pretty much on board. Maybe not in total agreement on style, but certainly on in the thrust of it, they seem to be behind. So we'll hear from those elite mouthpieces at the bottom of the hour. And we are joined now by Moha Peko. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. She is the director of the Africa Trade Network, which is a coalition of NGOs based in Johannesburg. Welcome to WBAI.
Thank you very much, Doug. It's great to be on WBAI.
And thank you for joining us at this late hour in Johannesburg. We're trying to get Patrick Bond on the line, but it's not working at the moment. So, but we'll see if we can raise him. But we do have you on the line. So let's take a retrospective at the World Summit on Sustainable Development. What was accomplished there? Do you think it accomplished its goals? Was it a success from the organizers' point of view?
Well, Doug, I think that this summit will probably go down as probably one of the most shameful summits of the 21st century. I think what we can call Rio plus 10 is probably Rio minus 10, because many of the agreements which were made at the first Rio summit in 1992 were rolled back by corporate globalization. And so we come away, instead of a package for advancing development, much-needed development in the world today, with a package that is really pandering to the needs of private interest and greed, and what President Museveni, the president of Uganda, said was promoting parasitic globalization rather than mutually beneficial multilateralism. And I think that the key issues that the social movements were fighting for throughout the continent of Africa and joined by many around the world, issues of land, issues of access to water, issues around the Kyoto Protocol, issues of ensuring that indeed poverty eradication does happen, issues of debt cancellation, which is so critical to Africa, and of course ensuring that the northern countries uphold their deal and promise of aid of 0.7% to the developing world. None of these happened, but instead we came away with what they call Type 2 partnerships, promoting public-private partnerships, as we know, privatization, and not surprising, companies like Vendi on the EU delegation and the Thames Water Company of London on the British delegation, which really shows who was lobbying behind the scenes to promote a corporatist globalization agenda at the summit.
And it was kind of ironic that they chose to have such a summit in Johannesburg, which is in many ways a model of unsustainability. Tell us, for example, about the consequences of privatization in South Africa.
There's no doubt that there are huge tensions today in this country, South Africa, around the privatization of water, the privatization of the electric company, which is moving very fast ahead towards the end of the year, the privatization of the railway, the privatization even of roads, where they're putting up toll gates everywhere. And the impact this has on workers, impact it has on people who did not have these services during the apartheid era, who will not enjoy these services in the future, and the lack of access, the lack of affordable health care, for example, because many of the hospitals are also going under privatization. So we are really in a mess in our new dispensation in South Africa, where everything that we value is up for sale to the highest bidder. And so there are deep tensions around this. The social movements, fortunately, are up in arms around this. We've got a very strong anti-privatization movement. We've also got a very strong landless people's movement, which has been fighting forced removals, which are so reminiscent of the apartheid era, where people were being moved from certain areas of the country and land being turned over to then the white regime. And it's almost unbelievable that the same things are happening now for people who need homes and are being removed from the very homes that they need into non-existence.
Well, in the apartheid era, the population removals and management were accomplished through the pass system and cops. Now it seems to be accomplished mainly through money. How do you fight what seems like a more abstract way of managing populations?
I think also, Doug, not just money, but I think what is even scary, I think, is the manner in which the very legislative process is being challenged by and changed by governments, the many amendments that are being made to the legislation to suit this sort of private interest. And the manner in which we have structured legislation around the process of owning land in this country is through the willing buyer, willing seller process. So the person who owns land must now be paid, for example, be paid in order for somebody else to acquire that land. And this is an extremely questionable and contentious way of promoting land reform in this country. This has happened across the border with our neighbor Zimbabwe. And for the past 20 years, they had this system. And, of course, now they're beginning to reverse it. We may disagree with the methodology, but certainly they're moving forward with their form of land reform. But I think that what is happening in this country around this system of really beginning to give over, give money to people for land that is questionable, how they attained that land, is going to be one of the most explosive situation in this country. Coupled with that is the war around the commons.
Well, yeah, let's talk about the commons in a moment, but I don't quite understand this approach to land reform, buying the land of people who probably shouldn't have had it in the first place. Who's supposed to come up with the money? We're talking about poor people who are landless. They certainly can't buy the land. Where's the money supposed to come from?
Well, no, they cannot. Apparently, government is supposed to buy this land and redistribute it. They do not have that sort of money. I just give an example. A few months ago, there was a very contentious case in one of our provinces here where a farmer had offered to sell his land to government, which was in dispute by a previous community that had lived there and had been removed by the apartheid government. And it should have made sense that people should have been put back on the land because they could prove that it was their land originally. The evaluators came. The valuators came and valuated the land. The farmer also got his valuators to come and valuate the land. They came up with different prices, and this thing went to court. But in the end, the government ended up paying the valuators that the farmer came up with, which was a scandalous amount of money. And if you continue in that process, government does not have the sort of money to pay millions of rand to farmers for this kind of land. And poor people certainly cannot afford to buy land. There are no subsidies for buying this land in the first place.
I'm speaking with Mahal Pico. I hope I'm not brutalizing your name too badly, who is the director of the Africa Trade Network, a coalition of NGOs based in Johannesburg. Well, let's talk about the commons, and what is this battle over the commons you alluded to earlier?
I think that the whole war over what is public and what is private in terms of water which in our constitution is reflected, by the way, as a right, and now government turning this over into private hands, and the whole notion of who really owns the commons, who owns the environment, who owns the land, who owns the energy sector, who owns all of these things that have been publicly owned by people for generations, and how then, how does government then rise above people's ownership of this to turn that over into private hands? And I think this is becoming one of the biggest wars, not just in South Africa, I think throughout the continent of Africa, this whole debate of what is public and what is private in terms of the commons that we share.
Now, it's kind of stunning for people abroad who admire the ANC during the years of struggle against apartheid. It's a party with at least substantial roots in socialist ideology. How did they come to be the apostles of privatization now that they're running the government?
Doug, we're asking ourselves the same questions. But I think that it's been very interesting to track ourselves in this country, coming from the Reconstruction and Development Plan, which was very much a people's-based plan that would reconstruct and develop the country in such a way that we do provide access to housing, water, all of the things that were denied to the African people in this country for generations, and towards GEAR, a macroeconomic, neoliberal economic policy, GEAR, which stands for Growth Economic GEAR, employment, growth and redistribution, and very much moving towards a neoliberal framework of looking at the economy, very export-driven, removing the power of the state, turning over public assets to the private sector. For us, I think that it's been a very interesting and a very frightening process, and as you quite rightly frame it, that how does a a socialist party move towards a totally right-wing capitalist party that moves away from understanding what people's needs are. I think that this is the question that we've been questioning in terms of Africa, in terms of how and when does the ideology change to such an extent that people would buy into corporate globalization and buy into this neoliberal Washington consensus in this country.
Do you have any sense of how much is the result of external pressure coming from, you know, the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank, IMF, and more recently the World Trade Organization? How much of this is homegrown?
I think that when you look at our trade policy and the manner in which South Africa has positioned itself within the World Trade Organization, for example, out of all the African countries, it has positioned them and aligned itself very much towards the EU, the US, Canadian, and Japanese positions, adopting the new issues around government procurement, for example, some very draconian investment measures, and a whole range of different things. I think that at one level, South Africa has been raised as a country that is has been projected as the engine of growth in South Africa, and I think many of our policymakers have sort of bought into that wholesale, and I think it has created a new sort of arrogance from our policymakers, almost as being better and above Africa, and there are tensions between us and other African countries where we are seen as big brother, and even the manner in which the European Union treats South Africa is different. The manner in which the U.S. government treats South Africa is quite different from the way that it treats other African countries. And I think this in and of itself has made South African policymakers feel that they are part of the boys' club. They are somehow acceptable and see themselves then as a broker. And of course, the Bretton Woods institutions have played the same role in elevating South Africa almost as a country that does not belong to Africa. It's a very sort of very strange, schizophrenic sort of way of looking at Africa, sort of cutting South Africa away from Africa and treating it differently and everybody else as the stepchildren of the continent. So it's a very, very strange, but it has had far-reaching outcomes for the continent and even, I think, undermines the whole question of African unity, even as we talk about the new Partnership for Africa's Development here in Africa. Again, South Africa is seen as a very key player, but obviously not everybody thinks that South Africa should be the principal or the head of the class.
Well, Patrick Bond, whom we can't get on the phone for some reason, but we tried. But when I've had Patrick on the show in the past, he has rather bluntly put it that South Africa thinks of itself really now as the continent's sort of junior imperialist. It's really going to be the top dog. Do you agree with that analysis?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the manner in which the European Union, I mean, it's my government, so I'm allowed to say this as a citizen. I think that the manner in which the European Union and the U.S., for example, treat Africa with contempt and constantly demand the opening of its market is the very same manner and tactics that the South African government uses towards other African countries in the region. And I think that we're seeing this in the manner in which South Africa's corporations are totally colonizing certain markets within the African continent, whether it's food. I mean, I was totally appalled flying into Lusaka a few weeks ago and going into one of the supermarket chains, which is here in South Africa. I mean, nothing in Zambia is sold in that particular supermarket. And in fact, even the bread, the dough is flown in every morning from South Africa into Zambia, which means that Zambians contribute absolutely nothing except their money to that particular supermarket chain, which is outrageous. And it is the same cry that we say that The EU and the US, is deindustrializing Africa by running roughshod over our markets and totally dumping all of the products that they've overproduced in their own countries and killing our markets off and creating anti-competitive tendencies and creating monopolies in the market is the very same tactics which our government uses towards other African countries. This is happening. People just have to travel to the continent and see which companies are really fast growing. And it's South African, mostly white, Africana companies that are growing within the African continent.
I'm speaking with Mohau Peko, who is the director of the Africa Trade Network, an NGO coalition based in Johannesburg. Let's turn to a somewhat more hopeful note then. There were tremendous protests around the World Summit on Sustainable Development. There are very active and growing social movements in South Africa. What was the contribution of the summit and the demonstrations around it to the development of that movement?
I think that what the social movements did through their march, particularly a march going through Alex, one of the poorest and oldest squatter informal housing areas in the city, and moving towards Sandton, which is a very pishy-poshy, high-class sort of neighborhood where the governments were meeting in this country, really juxtaposed, I think, the main issues and served, I think, as a reminder of what the real issues around sustainable development was. There was a collaboration of many social movements around the landless people who were demanding proper land reform in this country, joined by huge organizations like Via Campesina, made up of farmers and people demanding land throughout, including coalitions from Brazil, to the anti-privatization movement, people protesting against the privatization of water, the commons, electricity, basic services, the whole issue of, again, basic services being brought to the front of the agenda. And I think that the march, for me, symbolized what the real issues were, and contrasting what was happening on the street and what was not happening inside Sandton Convention Center, where governments were meeting, where they were talking about profiteers and moving the agenda towards corporate globalization, and juxtaposing this against people who were demanding very basic needs that are very necessary to all of us, I think really was an eye-opener for many people in the international community. And I think that it brought alive and reminded us that this summit on sustainable development is supposed to be about people, and the very people who should have been inside the convention, the Sandton Convention Center, were left outside protesting the issues and not able to influence the agenda on the inside. And I think this is a new area of protest for us, particularly in South Africa, where we've trusted government and felt that they would act in the public interest, only to discover that they are just as far away from the people as many governments, as many of the governments who were inside that convention center are from their own people. And I think that this was very symbolic for us in terms of really articulating quite clearly what the real issues were around this summit.
How difficult is it for people? The ANC is an institution with long and deep roots in South African society, one with a great deal of political capital. Has it really just worn out its welcome, and are people turning on it, or has it been very difficult to get people to organize against an ANC government?
I think that we're beginning to see the rise of people. I don't even want to say that it's so much against the ANC government as much as now what is becoming quite obvious, the ANC's policies, which are being challenged by people on the streets and communities everywhere. But I think that it's also important, Doug, to let people know that the level of repression that is also emerging out of resistance and protest in our country. Just a few days before the summit, over 74 landless people were arrested for the first protest march that happened just prior to the summit here in Johannesburg. And the manner, I think, in which they were arrested was unprecedented, I think, in this country post-apartheid. And I think that the fact that we're going to be seeing more of that, I think, begins to show to people that we are not dealing with the same ANC that was part of that was articulating socialism at one era. We are dealing with a very, very different animal than we were years ago. And I think this is becoming quite clear to people that their policies are quite far away from what people want. And in fact, our own policymakers share the same class interests of the capitalist classes in the North.
And finally, what's next for the social movements? What are the next activities and strategies you've got to fight the privatization and capitalization agenda?
I think that the World Summit on Sustainable Development, if we can call it that, I think has created an impetus, I think, of many activities that the social movements have been engaged in for many months and many years. I think that the statement that another Africa is better, another world is possible, is beginning to emerge in the manner in which we are looking at different alternatives. And I think that quite forcefully we are beginning to create strategies that says that, yes, people can own public resources. Yes, people can publicly manage their own water resources at the community level. And I think the whole notion of people's governance is becoming a very strong issue. And I think we're seeing this in resistance within the anti-privatization movement, which is going to, I think, intensify where the private companies come and turn the water off during the day and turn the electricity off during the day. And at night, we're going back into those communities and turning that water on and turning that electricity on. And it's becoming a new level of resistance for people. And I think that people are beginning to realize that whether or not government is willing to come to the negotiating table and talk to us as people, not as patients or needy people, but as people with economic interests at the table, we are going to take our rights back. We are not to even demand them from government, but I think we're going to take them forcefully if we have to. And I think we're beginning to see a reemergence of very strong protest throughout the continent. And I think this is extremely exciting, in particular as we begin to look at alternative ways of really bringing development to people that is indeed sustainable.
Well, best of luck. Very inspiring. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be in touch to get some updates. Thank you for joining us, Moha Peko, who is the director of the Africa Trade Network, a coalition of NGOs based in Johannesburg, and she stayed up pretty late into the South African night to speak with us. We'll be back in just a moment to hear from some very different kinds of people, some high and mighty from the Council on Foreign Relations. back. WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. My name is Doug Henwood, and this show is Behind the News. And that was a little snippet from the song Currents by Kingsook Biswas, I guess, from the collection Asian Travels, a rather culturally hybrid collection of Asian electronica and techno and dance sounds and trance sounds. And now we're going to play an interview recorded a few hours ago with Rachel Bronson, who is the Olin Senior Fellow and Director of Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. I thought there was some elite concern that maybe George Bush was a little reckless in pushing his war with Iraq, and I wanted to hear what the elite establishment types at the Council on Foreign Relations thought about it. I found out this today that it looks like they're pretty much behind W's plan. And most of the time we interview critics on this program, but here we are interviewing the thinkers and apologists for official action. So it's always worth having a taste of what they think. And here it is, the next half hour or so. First, we'll listen to Rachel Bronson from the Council on Foreign Relations, an interview recorded earlier today. Welcome to WBAI. What's your impressions of the president's speech this morning?
I thought the president gave a very strong speech, and there were several interesting parts of his speech and things that I was listening for. He clearly has decided, his administration has decided, that this is about regime change in Iraq. This isn't just about weapons of mass destruction, which in and of itself is a pretty big deal. This is about the whole package. I think that the international community at the UN will respond negatively to that part, but it leaves them options in very interesting ways. What it leaves them open to is when Saudi Arabia comes back and says, look, we're concerned that you're coming after us next, and the Iranians say, look, we're worried about you coming after us next. He has sort of made the case that Iraq is a particularly and uniquely hostile and horrifying regime. But the delegates at the UN would have been listening for whether this is about regime change, and I assume they're very concerned that it's not. I thought it was an excellent speech, though.
Let's put this in some context. There was a piece in The New Yorker, I guess, in April, and then there was one in the Boston Globe the other day, saying that this really is just the first stage in administration attempt to rewrite the whole political map of the Middle East. So they're really not going to stop at Iraq when it comes to regime change.
Well, I think that's true
in your view?
Well, I think there's some in Washington who would like to rewrite the whole Middle East. So I think that's important, that there really are some who are interested in that. I took away from the speech that the president isn't convinced of that. That the president, this speech to me was that Iraq is unique and horrifying. And I actually, that's a part of the speech that I like because I agree with it, but also because I think it will give him ammunition for those arguing this is all about rewriting the Middle East. This speech today wasn't about that.
Well, an awful lot of people around the world, including many of Iraq's neighbors, are not convinced of uniqueness or magnitude of this threat. Why, and even people within the president's own party aren't necessarily convinced, so why has it become a matter of such urgency?
Well, I actually think those in the region are pretty convinced that the magnitude of the threat is pretty high. They're not convinced with what our answers are. And I actually attribute that to very confusing policies from the Clinton administration. They had long been calling for Saddam's ouster, and it was the United States, if you remember, that was arguing for containment. Bush administration changed courses appropriately, I think, but it's not unreasonable to for those in the region to say, hey, wait a minute, you just changed course on us. We finally got used to this containment policy, which we didn't like to begin with, and now you're telling us that, no, you're going after Saddam. I don't think any of them are under any illusions about how awful this guy is. They're worried about, and reasonably so, they're worried about how serious are we about this, how committed are we to the day after issues, how committed are we to the stability of the region, are we going to rewrite the whole Middle East, do they have to be worried about that, or are we worried about this particular leader. So I do think they're actually, most states are on board with the magnitude of the problem. They're just not on board with how we're going to respond to it.
it looked like the president was giving the UN an ultimatum, do it our way or we'll do it alone. Is that, first of all, going to play well at the UN? Second of all, is that really what the UN is supposed to be all about?
No, it's not going to play well at the UN. No, it's not what the UN is all about. It wasn't, I had thought for most of the speech, actually, he was begging off that kind of position, but you're right. Then at the end, he really did make it clear, to the UN, do it or we'll do it ourselves. I think that was an unfortunate part of an otherwise very good speech.
Well, I think a lot of people might not believe us, might think his heart really isn't in it, that he's interested in the UN so far as it might provide some stamp of approval, but not really into the consultations and the collegiality and the compromise necessary.
Yeah, I think that's right. What I'm hoping is that the administration is actually learning that they have to work through the UN because it is actually what gives other countries, the European allies, Middle Eastern partners, the ability to go it with the United States. And so what I'm hoping is they're learning. But you may very well be right. This is just a cover for what they want to do, in which case what I also believe is that what they want to do is the right thing. The way they've gone about it is pretty ham-handed. This should have been first in their strategy rather than last. So I would agree with the part that the diplomacy leading up to this has been poor. I still don't think that detracts from what it is they're trying to do.
Well, it's almost like his dad and some of dad's colleagues have told him to cool his jets a little bit. Is that what's behind this change of heart?
No, because this speech today wasn't a cool your jets kind of speech. To me, what I was listening for was him to say something like, I'm a very patient man. That, then I would agree, it was a cool your jets kind of speech. It wasn't. What he said was, we have been more than patient, basically saying, we've tried everything and it hasn't worked. I thought this was the most determined, quite frankly, that I had seen Bush. Even though everybody had been saying he's determined, he's committed, I actually hadn't seen that. This speech, I thought, was pretty determined and committed.
If the threat from Iraq is so grave, why are most other countries so reluctant to sign on with the president's view of things?
That's really a good question, and there's a lot of different reasons for a lot of different countries. I think the evidence is out there. I think the president made a pretty compelling speech. I think every country has different concerns. I think there's a lot of whatever the Americans say will sort of argue the opposite. I've seen a lot of that, quite frankly, in the Persian Gulf. I was out there just a couple years ago, 2 years ago, and everybody was arguing, do something, do something. So I think that there's a lot of whatever the U.S. does, it must be wrong. I think there is a concern that the U.S. is diplomatically handling this poorly, and for the rest of the world that matters a lot because diplomacy really is their bread and butter of politics. And there is a concern that we're not even attempting to play by the rules, and I think they're right on that. And so there's a criticism on that. We make it harder for states that would otherwise want to join with us. We make it harder for them to do so. And for some, I think that they have a different. They're comfortable with containment. I think some in Europe are very comfortable containing Saddam. They don't believe that he would actually use these things. I actually, one of the lessons I did take from September 11th is when someone says they're basically at war with you, you take them seriously. I think we are in a war with Saddam. We've been for the last, 11 years since the end of Desert Storm, or I guess for 12 years since the beginning. We've been at war with him. We constantly have flights going over Iraq, and they're constantly trying to shoot us down. They're not abiding by UN, the whole thing. So I do believe, and some just don't, but I think there's a whole host of reasons that others disagree with us, and we have to try to manage each set of reasons.
Well, what do you make of something coming from somebody like Dick Armey, who says, this guy's a blowhard, and, we don't like him, he's not a nice guy, but he's really not that threatening to his neighbors. When somebody like Dick Armey says that, what do you make of that?
I disagree with Dick Armey. I think if you just read the local press, you can see how awful he is to his neighbors. He's constantly calling for the downfall of the regimes around him. He makes it very difficult for them to conduct any political activity that's not at their liking. I think he's very destabilizing for the regimes there. I think he's destabilizing for very important relations we've built up with these countries. Look at the state of our relations with Jordan, Turkey, Saudi Arabia. They're under enormous stress. Why? Because we have to have a large military presence because this guy's so aggressive. He came south with his military in 1994, which a lot of people forget. 1996, he went north. This is a guy who's on the move, and there's no doubt in my mind that if we didn't have our military surrounded him, that he would try again and again. So I actually just disagree with the Dick Armey. I don't think the facts are on his side.
Now, what about the regional consequence? I mean, The Economist, which is not exactly a peacenik publication, has a piece, I believe, in this week's issue saying pretty much everyone in the Arab world hates us now. Don't you think there's some risk that a move against Iraq would deepen that?
Yeah, you know, this is how I see some of the anti-Americanism. I think a lot of it has to do with the peace process. A lot of it has to do with the frustration that the U.S. hasn't offered a particularly hopeful sort of policy towards the Middle East and economic or other issues. But I actually see it a little differently than The Economist. I see that anti-Americanism has been on the rise, and one of the reasons it's been on the rise is because we've had such an aggressive military presence in the region. We never had that before Desert Storm. We didn't have to have that before Desert Storm. We operated from our aircraft carriers and from Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, an island that we rent from the British. So they didn't really see us. Saddam Hussein has had to, because of Saddam Hussein, we've had to be very present. I believe that's contributing to a large portion of anti-Americanism. And so that has been one of the reasons that I believe we really do have to deal with this problem, because it's terrible for our relations with these countries, that it's contributing to anti-Americanism, that it's not sustainable, that it's only going to get worse. And yes, I think that given the state of relations now, an attack on Iraq will, I think it won't be loved, but I think it will. Actually, it won't lead to the kinds of flames in the streets that people are talking about. I think that leaving the problem there to fester year after year, to me, that is the greatest threat to our relations with those countries.
Well, another part of the problem is also the United States supports Israel almost unquestioningly, and Israel has violated UN resolutions and has a couple of hundred nuclear weapons. What's the standard of judgment in accepting nuclear weapons and violating UN resolutions? Is it just whether the United States likes you or not?
Well, no, I don't think that's what it is. I think that's why the president actually laid out the case that he did. It's, look, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and we're not threatening the same thing against Pakistan as we do against Iraq. There's a lot, you know, the Russians have nuclear weapons, the Chinese have nuclear weapons. There's a number, unfortunately, of states that have nuclear weapons. The concern with Iraq is, I don't think anybody should have any confidence that if he had these things, he wouldn't use them. I think all his behavior has suggested that he would use them. So in my mind, it's not just about having these things. It's about intent, and that politics is largely about intent. Unlike the Soviet Union, we knew what their capabilities are during the Gulf War. We weren't sure what their intentions were. I think right now with Iraq, we breathe a big sigh of relief about their capabilities because we know full well what their intentions are. And so there is a desperate concern that he's trying to acquire these things at a time when every other political mechanism that we can use, we've already tried and it hasn't worked. And that's what the greatest fear is. There are a lot of other countries that aren't under the same kinds of restrictions as Iraq is, for very good reason. Their behavior has been very different.
Well, let's assume that the military phase of this goes as planned or as hoped. What plans do you think the United States has for a post-war Iraq? It's not as if there's a natural opposition that we could cultivate and put in place to govern the country, as there was even in Afghanistan.
Well, there is a natural opposition. It's not an organized opposition. And I think just like we couldn't predict that Hamid Karzai would be the president of Afghanistan, you can't necessarily predict who's going to be next for Iraq. But Iraq's going to be very tricky, and quite frankly, that's why I think we have to be very careful about what we do in Afghanistan, because the world is looking at Afghanistan to see how we do day after, as we call them, day after activities. And so the fact that the administration is very slowly learning that they have to have a true presence, that they have to have a large true presence, that we have to be involved in the reconstruction of Afghanistan, I think are hopefully important lessons that they're learning in Washington about what Iraq's going to be like. We're going to have to be very active. But there's going to be a lot of others in the region. There's going to be a lot of others, including Russia, France, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey, who want to be very involved as well. And so the trick will be to fashion some kind of arrangement whereby most of those countries are satisfied with the result.
Well, so far the United States is not coming up with much in the way of money for the rebuilding of Afghanistan. I think they've appropriated $250 million, which is pocket change, really. Is there going to be a better performance, or is this about it?
I don't think that the problem is money from the United States. The United States, that amount of money is pocket change to us. If you look at what the state of Afghanistan is, that's a lot of money. The problem is the Europeans and others who have promised money haven't forked it over, and I think that's the real problem. The problem for us has been the security side of it, that we've been reluctant to put forward security, and the Europeans and others come to us and say, we're not going to put more money in unless you guys give more security. And we say, we're not going to give security until you do put more money in. And so the challenge is for, I think, for us to say to Washington, we really do need to expand our presence in Afghanistan. But, you know, that's going to entail casualties. It's a costly policy, but I think it's the right policy. For the Europeans and for some other Asian countries, I think the appropriate response is, look, if we do this, you really need to come forward with money because you guys have been holding it up on that side.
Well, what do you see in the coming weeks? Will the U.S. be able to get some approval at the U.N.? Is it going to be a hard slog?
You know, that's the $64,000 question. I think anything at the U.N. is going to be a hard slog, so I would expect it to be a hard slog, and I'll be watching it very closely because I think that the president did some interesting things. One is, as I said in the beginning, he talked about regime change, and they're not going to like that one bit. But what he did do also is he made a very, very compelling case, I think, about why this regime is unique. And so it's going to put the – it really does put the ball back in the U.N. court. And what I hope is this administration devotes the sort of the time and attention to the U.N. to really work this issue through. What I'd fear is in things that they've shown them – their past pattern suggests that they're just going to leave this out there and then go busy themselves with some other issues. If they stay very, very focused on this issue, I think they'll get support, but it's going to depend a lot on them staying very focused.
There's a cynical interpretation that this is just because they can't find Osama, so now they need to go after someone else to keep up the enthusiasm for foreign adventures. What do you think of that?
I think it's ridiculous. I think that the people at high levels of this administration signed a letter in 1998 to then-President Clinton calling for a more hard-headed approach towards Iraq. These guys have been on this case since before they were in power, and there's not many issues you could say that about. And this wasn't just the president. This is senior members at the National Security Council, senior members at the Pentagon, senior members of the State Department who signed this letter. They have been out. They have been very concerned about Iraq and the negative effects it's having on our policy. I don't think this is a bid to distract the American people. I think if there's been one foreign policy issue where they've been consistent on, it's been Iraq.
Okay, thank you for joining us, Rachel Bronson.
Okay, thank you.
And that was Rachel Bronson, who is the Olin Senior Fellow and Director of Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And now, another great and good person from the Council on Foreign Relations, David Phillips, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow of the Center for Preventive Action. What a nice Orwellian term that is. David Phillips.
Welcome to WBAI. What is a Center for Preventive Action? What are you trying to prevent?
We're trying to prevent deadly conflict around the world.
What's your opinion of the Bush administration's approach towards Iraq?
Well, Iraq represents a real menace to international peace and security. That's why the UN Security Council has adopted a series of resolutions calling on Iraq to disarm. It's quite clear that Iraq has violated its international obligations and that the urgency of addressing the situation is greater now than ever before.
What criteria do you use for judging Iraq's danger to the world?
Because UN weapons inspectors haven't had access to any sites for the past 4 years, it's not possible to estimate the precise extent of Iraq's nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons program. We do know that Saddam has been trying to acquire nuclear material. We also know from past experience that he's used chemical agents on his own citizens as well as on neighboring countries. I don't think anyone disputes the fact that Saddam is a danger.
Did you approve of what seems to be the Bush administration's preference for U.S. action regardless of what the U.N. Approves of?
I think the preference of the Bush administration is to pursue a multilateral approach. It's the UN's responsibility to enforce its resolution. It's the international community's shared concern that Saddam is developing weapons of mass destruction. The point that was made by President Bush today is that if the UN isn't prepared to enforce its resolution and require weapons inspectors, then the U.S. would have to act unilaterally.
Why do you think that other nations don't seem to perceive Iraq as the urgent danger that the Bush administration does, and even some members of Bush's own party don't perceive quite the imminent threat that he seems to, and the people around him?
Well, both President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair promised to release a portfolio of information documenting their concerns. I suggest that the jury's still out and that we wait until that material is in hand and then make an informed decision about the best way to proceed.
And if the United States doesn't get the Security Council to go along with its judgment, do you think the U.S. should act alone, or should it be constrained by the wishes of its partners?
I think that the Security Council will act in favor of a very robust weapons inspection program. I suspect that 14 countries will vote in favor. Syria will be the only one to abstain. The question then is, how does the international community react if the weapons inspection is not able to complete its work, or if Saddam cheats and retreats, as we suspect that he will? One can look at the series of Security Council resolutions, both in the past and immediately upcoming, as building diplomatic support for war.
The mere possession of weapons of mass destruction, there are other countries that have these weapons. India and Pakistan certainly do. Israel certainly does. Israel has repeatedly defied UN resolutions to withdraw from the occupied territories. What's the standard of judgment? Is it just regimes the United States doesn't like?
I don't think it's a unilateral decision. There's international consensus that Saddam Hussein's regime is one of the most heinous anywhere in the world. I myself visited Iraq after the poison gas attack against the Kurds in Halabja in the late 80s. So I saw firsthand the level of destruction that Saddam's capable of. I saw a commentary recently in which the Halabja attacks were described as merely an experiment for a much broader use of poison gas and other agents of mass destruction that Saddam might contemplate.
Let me ask the question again directly. Israel has repeatedly ignored UN resolutions to withdraw from the occupied territories. It possesses weapons of mass destruction. Why is it not perceived as an international outlaw in the same way?
Israel doesn't have a history of using weapons of mass destruction, nor is it likely that it would. Israel is a democracy, and it's supported by the United States. It also enjoys support in other countries around the world. It is not appropriate to compare the two situations. They're entirely different.
There's also been some reports lately that the United States either looked the other way or even tacitly approved of Iraq's actions during the Iran-Iraq War, which may have included the gassing. Does Iraq's history as at least a furtive ally of the United States, is that just ancient history and now forgotten, or is that relevant in the present situation?
I think the reports were specifically that some of the aerial satellite photography might have been used by Iraq in deploying its poison gas attacks during the Iran-Iraq War. I'm not aware of any specific endorsement by the United States of the use of chemical or biological agents.
And as for the administration's approach to the United Nations, I mean, the New York Times headline expresses this morning that, you know, basically it's do it our way or we'll do it alone. Is that really the proper way to go about diplomacy, in your view?
The purpose of diplomacy is to build consensus and support. I don't see a huge gap between the Secretary General's appeal for multilateralism and the speech that President Bush gave. The posture of the U.S. is to work through multilateral institutions when they advance U.S. interests. Clearly, the U.N. has a very important role to play here. That's why the preferred option is for the Security Council to authorize robust weapons inspection. If it does so and those proceed effectively, that would obviate the need for war. You know, we'll have to see what unfolds in the immediate future.
So then the criterion is whether the United Nations advances U.S. interests, and if it doesn't, then we work around it?
I mean, U.S. interests and global interests are the same here. Everyone shares a desire to eradicate Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. I'd say there's unanimity amongst members, states at the U.N., that Saddam is the head of a rogue regime that's a menace to us all. There's not a lot of blue sky between the U.S. position and the position of the rest of the world. The means by which we accomplish an enforcement of Iraq's international obligation is what's being debated at the U.N. as we speak.
And what do you see next? What are the courses of action and the coming milestones?
I would suggest that next week that Great Britain will introduce a resolution in the Security Council calling for weapons inspectors. There will be a deadline of 21 days to a month for those inspectors to be deployed. Then the Hans Blix, the chief UN's weapons inspector, will have 60 days to prepare a work plan. The work plan is not just a technical document. It also includes a recommendation about the viability of conducting credible inspection. Now, if at any point in the preparation of that plan or the conduct of comprehensive inspection, Iraq cheats and retreats, then I think the UN weapons inspector will be compelled to discontinue his dialogue with the Baghdad regime and pull his inspectors out. And that would, in effect, constitute a green light for military action.
And a number of people, even prominent, respectable Republicans, have worried that an action against Iraq would threaten the anti-terror coalition and might throw that whole neighborhood of the world into even more turmoil than it is in already. Do you have any concerns about that?
The global fight against terrorism was initially targeting terrorist groups. Then, in going after the Taliban, it targeted states that harbor terrorist networks. It now seems to be evolving to target terror states. Whether or not the U.S. is able to hold together its coalition will depend in large part on its success in achieving measurable goals to make the world a safer and more peaceful place. I'm grateful for the chance to speak with you today and look forward to seeing what events unfold in the near future.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you.
And that was David Phillips, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations, and his expertise, according to the Council's website, is human rights, humanitarian action, conflict prevention, and mediation, but doesn't stop them from beating the war drums. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. We're out of time, so I better get moving. Till next week, goodbye. We'll be right back.